Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. I have to give this to Trump, Donald Trump. His ability to shock me is unparalleled. Like, just when I thought he couldn't possibly disgust me anymore, he comes out and says that there were fine people among those neo-Nazis and white supremacists who marched through Charlottesville with torches, like beating people in the street. Until one of them launched a terror attack that killed a 32-year-old woman and wounded 19 others. And he followed that with what was essentially like the most dim-witted white nationalist argument about Confederate memorials and erasing our history. He said that George Washington and Robert E. Lee both had slaves, so what was the difference? And it's just remarkable. This is the president of the United States. Like, how brain dead does one have to be to not see the difference? You know, Lee didn't just own slaves. He led a rebellion against the United States in defense of chattel slavery. And then Trump broke out that ridiculous story about General Pershing executing Muslims in the Philippines with bullets dripped in pig's blood. He said they didn't have a radical Muslim problem for 35 years. Now, he said this as he was decrying those who want to bring down those Confederate memorials for trying to rewrite history, right? He's whining about rewriting history, and he was blatantly rewriting history. Like, first and foremost, that never happened. It's a fake story. And then, of course, the Moro weren't radical Islamists. They were fighting colonial powers in their homeland. And then he says they had these 35 years of peace, but they never stopped fighting. The Moros fought the Spanish, then they fought the Americans, and then they fought the Japanese. Steve Bannon apparently coached Trump about his response to Charlottesville. He was thrilled with his boss's statements. His staff, or the rest of his staff, were reportedly miserable and also surprised that he said in public the racist claptrap that he apparently says all the time in private. So this was Trump. Trump unchained. The guy had no filter. He was just saying what he says all the time in private, like your racist Uncle Bob, who you don't take very seriously. Now Bannon's gone, but I think the white nationalist movement will probably be closer to Trump than ever. Also, make no mistake, Trump doesn't give a crap about these beautiful monuments or our culture. He just saw a poll which showed that 62% of the public favor keeping those monuments in place. And then he saw another poll which showed that only 35% of the public approved of his comments. So he would just try to change the conversation. And I'll tell you something, it will not surprise me at all if you see those numbers on the monuments shift, because Trump has made the Affordable Care Act more popular. You've seen a increase in positive views of immigration. This is the other Trump effect, the anti-Trump effect. He takes a position on monuments. I think a lot of people are going to be thinking, yeah, we should take those monuments down just because he's defending them and he's so odious. Anyway, we're not taking the bait. This week, we're not going to talk about monuments. We're going to talk about white supremacists and what happened in Charlottesville. We'll be joined first by Scott Crowe. He's an author and longtime Antifa organizer. And we'll talk about these people who are fighting back against these hopping mad white guys and some of the controversies that have arisen around their tactics. And then we'll be joined by David Nywert. He's the Pacific Northwest correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligent Report. And he's also the author of the upcoming book, Alt-American, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. So a timely guest there. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then get on with the show.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach. So you get what we had here last week, which is the way he wants it. Well, he gets. I don't like him any more than you think.
at your women crying. Look at your young men dying the way they've always done before. Look at the hate we're breeding. Look at the fear we're feeding. Look at the lives we're leading.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. Antifa or anti-fascist groups have been the source of some controversy on the left for as long as I can remember, and that's become kind of more prominent since the election of Trump with the empowerment of all these far-right white supremacist whack jobs, right? They've kind of come into the open. They're often looking for a fight, and Antifa is often happy to give them just what they're looking for. I'm joined now by Scott Crowe. He is an author, but he was a longtime Antifa organizer. Scott, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Let's start with some real basics, and I don't want to take too long with this, but is Antifa distinct from the Black Bloc?
Absolutely. Antifa, you can be communist, radical, of any stripe to be Antifa. Anybody who wants to stand up to fascism can take the label of Antifa. Black Bloc in and of itself is a tactic that Antifa people use, but came out of anarchist circles, and it's mostly used by anarchist organizing around street protests and street mobilizations. So they can cross over. That's why people get confused about them. But they are two distinct things. One's a tactic and one's a political ideology.
Okay. And it's a political ideology that has its roots, its deep roots in Nazi Germany, but I think it's fair to say that it's kind of modern iteration began in the UK in the 1980s. Is that right?
That's right. And
yeah, okay.
It came across the US in the 90s.
Well, with the rise of the militia movement and all of that. So, I mean, there's a certain logic there. Does the fact that this is kind of an anti-hierarchical movement make it difficult to talk about it in general terms? I mean, maybe that wasn't the clearest question. Can we talk about a broad movement when an Antifa group in Oakland may look different from one in Charlottesville, or is there a common thread?
there's common threads in that, right, which is that to stop fascism physically and confront fascist ideology where it is, either in the streets or where those people may be speaking or on their websites or any place where they are trying to gain a public forum within music circles or anything. And so so the networks are there's informal networks all over the place that operate very similarly. It's very much based on the ideas of like anarchy also, which is like you have a core base of ideas and then they look differently everywhere you go. You know, like a forest looks the difference on the West Coast as it does on the East Coast, but they have similar elements to them. There's trees and flora and fauna, but they're made up differently. It's the same with Antifa movements and the crossover with anarchy.
And let's dig into some of the issues here. In this country, I've written recently for The Nation, the extreme right has had a near monopoly on serious political violence. And I am talking about, you know, lethal political violence since the end of the Vietnam War era. Extreme right-wing terrorism is a greater threat in this country than Islamic right-wing terrorism. Yet claims that both sides do it or even that the left is responsible for violence are pretty ubiquitous, not just from the right, but you see this from the mainstream. It's a false equivalence, but the only reason it can really exist is because there are people on the broad left who are in fact willing to engage in street fights, and that certainly produces video of people, you know, armored up with their faces covered, carrying sticks that Fox News can play over and over. So, I mean, is there a concern that Antifa does in fact obscure the violent nature of extreme right-wing politics? And do you think that's problematic?
It doesn't matter because Antifa has a singular goal to shut down fascism. It doesn't matter what the media says. And that's always been that. The other thing to draw to your first point, though, that right-wing terrorism is not being labeled as terrorism since Vietnam, I would argue that it's since the history of the United States, that right-wing terrorism, what we call right-wing terrorism, the killing and murder of judges, the Ku Klux Klan, all of these things have a task to the state because many of them are the state. When I say the state, I'm talking about government in all its forms, right? Like, because members of the Ku Klux Klan historically have been sheriffs, police departments, mayors. You know, they are in the government. So of course they never look at violence as domestic terrorism as they do for anything else. You know, I mean, I was labeled a domestic terrorist for almost 10 years for animal rights and radical environmental movements. I never killed anybody. I never threatened to kill right. anybody in my life. But right. people who actually do murder people or threaten to murder people or drive their car into people and murder people, they still, you know, all the politicians should be saying domestic terrorism. If you're going to call anything domestic terrorism, that's what they should do. But I think there's a tacit complicity that goes hand in hand. Look at the three percenters and the oath keepers, both armed groups that can come into places where you can't carry open carry, and they do, and the police don't shut them down, not because the police are afraid of them, because the state has more power, because they are complicit, because it is them. There are many members who are crossover from the military and the police department, and so they are turned back. Well, when you have a bunch of Antifa people who come out with billy clubs and sticks and maybe even Molotov cocktails to fight that, we do get labeled as violent as that. But I'll, you know, like I will ask over and over again, how many people have Antifa killed in the last 40, 50, 60, 80 years? And I'm going to tell you, it's zero.
Right. Well,
zero.
But I'm talking
not
about,
even by accident, you know?
Right. I'm talking about perception rather than reality. And let me just clarify, when I said since the Vietnam War era, what I was referring to is that during the Vietnam War era, there was violence on the left. So it wasn't just
absolutely.
The right wing. Since the Vietnam War era ended, it has been almost exclusively on the right. So, okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I totally agree with that.
I'm a political writer, and so I'm tuned into how the media covers things. And I find, I've had some experience covering various anarchist groups, and I find it frustrating, this idea that it doesn't matter what the media says, because most people get their ideas of what's going on through the media. And I've heard this when I was covering Occupy Wall Street. You know, the media is so corrupt that it's not worth worrying about how they portray things, or this is our only goal, we don't care. I mean, do you not recognize that results in the worst possible coverage. Like that.
Let me give you an example. So the media has shifted, right? We understand that it used to be a corporate monopoly of media, right? Like it was the big three television stations and the big print papers, right? And the big cable networks. It's not like that anymore. So for anarchists or people within Antifa movements to forego corporate mainstream media doesn't mean that they're foregoing media. There's just a myriad of opportunities that they can reach tens of thousands of other people. I mean, I talk to alternative media all the time, and sure, it doesn't have the reach the New York Times has, but it has significant reach depending on who you reach. I mean, I can still reach 100,000 people on a particular piece, and you couldn't do that before. So when I say that Antifa or anarchists don't care about media, they don't care about corporate media, and they're very distrustful of corporate media. And you know, for me, I work with Agency, which is an anarchist PR firm. So that's why we engage with it, because we think it's a valuable tool to talk to corporate owned media, as well as alternative forms and counter forms of media. And so I think that for us, we see that as a role that we can do. And then, you know, in a particular topic like this is really important, because anarchist ideas that cross over into like Antifa work or anything else often are marginalized and have always been marginalized, you know, like with bomb throwing and stuff and corporate media. So that's why there's a long history of not wanting to do that. But we have found that we can make inroads. And you know, like for me to be able to talk with you, I think is really good, because I can talk to you about really deep Antifa ideas, and I can talk about anarchist ideas and not be maligned in doing that. And those opportunities are newer to everything. And so I think it's just an emerging paradigm shift that everybody's going through and that, but people don't understand it. When you talk to people at Occupy, they don't understand. They know they don't want to talk to corporate media because they're going to be maligned, but they are talking to media.
I was covering it for Alternate. So, I mean that.
The other piece I think is really, really important in this is that most of these movements are very young. Like yes. Young in age and young in political maturity. And you know, like each new uprising brings in a whole new group of people who don't have any experience in dealing with media or know what to think about media, because they have never had anything. And if they engage with it, it's usually probably pretty bad. They get made fun of, or their ideas are disturbed because they don't know how to talk to the media. And so there's a long distrust. But think about that. It's just because they're new. It's not because they have some like deep analysis of why they hate the media.
I think that's a really important point. I mean, we need to remember that these are youth movements. And, you know, I get so tired of people trashing, you know, college kids as if they weren't idiots when they were in college. I mean, older people, you know what I mean?
Oh my gosh, of course.
I'm in my 40s, and, you know, I was dumb as a rock when I was in college. And the idea that we should expect people who are, you know, 19 or 20, maybe they've just left home for the first time in a while. And I'm talking about college activism now, which is not exactly on topic. But you know, the idea that they should like be sophisticated and understand how these things are portrayed in the media and stuff, it is unrealistic. But let me actually shift a little bit. And this is getting into where Antifa and college activism come together. So, here, I think that there is a criticism, which I find fairly valid, and that is that there is not always care taken to differentiate between like fascists and obnoxious conservatives. So if you look at Spencer, right, he's a white supremacist. Mm-hmm. He advocates for what he calls a nonviolent ethnic cleansing of people of color from this country. But then Ann Coulter is just a disgusting pundit. She's just a right-wing grifter. The actually fascistic things she says are a naked bid for attention, an attempt to sell books.
Does well with that, you know.
She like does, absolutely.
Race baiting and fascist baiting, she does
oh,
well.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, but I mean, like, the difference between an Ann Coulter talk and this massive rally by white supremacists that we just saw in Charlottesville seems significant. Does not differentiating between those two things not perpetuate the idea that both sides are prone to violence or give credence to the right's nonsense about free speech?
Okay, so let me think back up. People like Ann Coulter are part of a larger system, right? They are the system. She is a part of power, which is capital P power, like those who assume to control the rest of us through government, media, things like that. Like, I'm not saying it's a secret cabal, but like those who have it. So what they do and what they say is, if they open a space, if Ann Coulter doesn't have to say, we hate black people, to she can speak in coded language. And what it does is it opens, like in my analysis, it opens up spaces for people like Richard Spencer to go, oh, there's a safe area for us to be able to do this. Like people like Ann Coulter open this very liberal way, just which is exactly like what I do on very radical ideas, on very radical leftist ideas and anarchist ideas of talking to, you know, like talking with you right now about this. Like I open up a space where I can talk about things that are very radical, and then people can also can figure out what they want to do with that. So I think that it is a spectrum that should be looked at. The other thing is, it's not two sides. It's not like left versus right. It's actually bigger than that, because the alt-right is the pariah and the parasite on the larger structural system of institutional racism, right? Like you talk about prisons, and you're talking about schools and housing and all the things that we talk about when we talk about racism. And so people like Ann Coulter or the tiny-handed orange one who is the president of the United States, that when they don't condemn things, when they say both sides are fighting, that's not true, because people like anarchists or Antifa or any small movement, we are fighting against a system. We're trying to break open systems, systematic racism, systematic white supremacy. You know, I'm using political terms, but there's more than that. But you say trying to move towards collective liberation. That is not an equal fight. We are actually coming up from below and trying to open up spaces to actually dismantle those systems. And that's totally different than saying it's a fair fight. They have this on one side and we have this on the other side, and now let's go at it.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Scott Crowe about Antifa, the anti-fascists who confront the growing white supremacist movement in this country, or the more energized, I should say, white supremacist movement in this country. Scott, I want to turn back to this issue of open carry. I think that a great concern is that, you know, if you say, okay, we should fight fascists, we are ultimately bringing that proverbial knife to a gunfight at this point in places that are open carry. And if it comes down to it, like, isn't it just an objective fact that with the militia movement and all that, that they do, in fact, outgun the left?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. The left disarmed itself basically after the 1970s. You know, the peace movements and the nonviolent contingents really, really came to dominate leftist subculture. And with the failure of many of the communist movements and stuff, we became a very passive and very reactionary set of movements. And so what you have now, though, is you have a rebuilding that's actually happening. And it's funny, because I actually have a book coming out called Setting Sights, Histories and Reflections on Community Armed Self-Defense. And basically the premise of it is that showing how these groups and individuals have used arms as part of larger organizing tactics to fight fascists and neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan for over 100 years. And this is groups that are non-state actors who don't become standing armies or do bombing brigades or any of that stuff, or use armed propaganda. And so there's actually right now is a resurgence in the left for the first time, because I've been carrying guns for almost 20 years, and I had rejected guns for a long time, but I have carried guns. But there's a new resurgence now. We have groups like Redneck Revolt, the Huey Newton Gun Club in Dallas, all these groups that are kind of coming, all these leftist groups who are starting to take up guns again, because the right has been arming itself at a breakneck pace since the 90s. Now, the left is not trying to match that, but people are thinking differently about it. And your analogy of saying, like, we're bringing, you know, we're going to make it into a gunfight by, you know, we're turning knife fights into gunfights could be true. But I believe, and I think in my analysis, at some point that the gunfight has already been brought to us, because when you have like Dylann Roofs walking in and shooting people, when you have people shooting people all over the place from right-wing views, murdering individuals, that is a gunfight already, except that the other side is just not armed and didn't know that they were in a cultural war with that. So what I think now is that you have some symbology of groups from the left saying, okay, we're not just weak. We will stand in the way that you understand that. And then my question is, can we stand in that way with guns at those events and then actually create liberatory spaces where guns don't become the dominant macho culture that they already are, that they actually become a liberatory tool that you only bring out when you need it? The other thing is, I think that's only one way to fight. Antifa has been fighting this way forever, ever since the Nazis, even before the Nazis. You can go back to the 1920s and 30s and fighting the fascists in Spain. Anarchists have been fighting this way for a long time, and it always has its limits. We should always recognize the Antifa reactionary model has very, very, very limited play, like street battles and mass organizing in a certain way. But the ideas I've seen as watershed change is that mainstream corporate media is talking about it in terms that has never been talked about before. And I think the gun element is actually because you're seeing armed left people like in Redneck Revolt show up against fascists, I think has brought that conversation to a new head.
That's really interesting because I have not seen, and I want to distinguish between, you know, Dylann Roof and the shootings and the people who go to these protests and say we are just exercising our Second Amendment rights. They claim that they're, you know, not trying to intimidate people. This idea, and you see it increasingly in open carry states, right wingers just carrying, and they won't even put their fingers on the trigger. They'll just have it like slung around their back.
But that's the word.
I haven't seen that from the left yet. Is that happening?
Well, you're not in Texas. come to my neighborhood. I'll show you. And it's like I spoke on the state capitol at a constitutional rally, and I actually spoke against the Constitution. But I was saying like, let's destroy the Constitution. I was like, we don't need it for liberation. I stood there in 2011 in this thing. There was armed people everywhere, and this is when it was open carry, but it wasn't. You couldn't carry loaded stuff. There was guys there. I thought were going to shoot me for saying anything against the Constitution. Yeah. Now, if you go to a state capitol in Austin, Texas, you'll see left commie groups there. You'll see left anti-fascist groups with guns, and both of these groups. And then you'll also see the 3%ers and the Oath Keepers and different right-wing groups. Now, and also you brought up a really important point. There's a spectrum of people on the right, like from Ann Coulters and the David Horowitzes and those kind of people onto the Dylann Roofs and then on further down to the Richard Spencers, right? And so the 3%ers and the Oath Keepers, you know, they're in that spectrum, but they don't necessarily agree with Ann Coulter, right? But they also don't necessarily agree with Richard Spencer. But they're still in there because they're still coming from this old school right wing populist view that's against government tyranny. But it's very abstract what that government tyranny is. I mean, we saw it in Charlottesville, right? Because we saw a group, you know, one of the Oath Keepers all around the country had a debate whether they were going to go to Charlottesville at all. And then once a group finally decided, they wanted to make sure that they distanced themselves from the fascist groups that were there. But still tacitly, they look like the fascists, and they look like, even under the guise of protecting free speech. Now, are they just politically stupid? Maybe so. Politically immature? Definitely so. But they have guns, and that's super important to think about. And I definitely would make a distinction between the armed Oath Keepers and the armed, white vanguard groups as different distinct groups. But there's a crossover there that doesn't cross over to the left. Like, Oath Keepers aren't coming to protect free speech of Antifa activists or anywhere. If there's examples there, they've got to be very limited.
I'm gonna disagree a little bit because I think that those groups are savvy in terms of their media relations, and I think that they actually are very much aligned ideologically with the white supremacist groups that were on that were in Charlottesville. I think that they're savvy in terms of saying that they distance themselves from those beliefs, but I think that those beliefs are pervasive in the movement. And you saw this, for example, like in the Bundy Ranch, right? I mean, it didn't take long for Bundy to go from like, oh yeah, the government is oppressing me, to let me tell you something that I know about the Negro. You know what I'm saying?
Right. But let's take it out of abstracts. those people, the Oath Keeper kind of people, that are the people in my family. I know them. I've grown up with them all my life. I live in a libertarian state. Texas is a libertarian state. I know the difference between a KKK member and somebody who has libertarian minded that is not politically mature. And so I wouldn't, I am hesitant, and I would not say that Oath Keepers are media savvy whatsoever. That's very interesting you say. As a media person also, that would not be my thing to say at all about them. I would like, yeah, you guys, I mean, they get good media because they carry guns, but I'm like, are they actually working the media? I don't know. I mean, that's, we could disagree on that for sure. Yeah. But I want to be careful to not throw everybody in, just like we were talking about the Ann Coulter and the Richard Spencer. I want to throw everybody who's an Oath Keeper under the bus and saying that they're racist in the way that Richard Spencer is racist. Many of them are racist in the way that America is racist, that okay, people don't want to admit they're racist.
Fair enough, but let me distinguish, because I'm just saying to clarify that I was talking about the leadership, and I forget the guy's name, the main Oath Keeper. But let's move on, because I don't want to take too much time with that. I want to stick with the idea of the left increasingly open carrying, and I have a few thoughts of this, because it seems to me that on the one hand, it's a recipe for a bloodbath. Like, you know, if you have
absolutely
people lined up on both sides with, you know, semi-automatic rifles, it's only a matter of time before you just need one person to lose his or her cool, right? And then you have a big shootout. And then yet, on the third hand, I wonder if that's the kind of thing that needs to happen before politicians decide that permitting open carry at protests maybe isn't such a great idea. And I wonder how open carry impacts this discussion as far as, like, in Europe, where Antifa, the modern Antifa, was born in the 1980s, it was like you were dealing with soccer hooligan / right wing.
Right.
Right. And they weren't armed. So I don't know.
Think about this too. Like, that's a really good comparison to make. And I do believe that I do think that I am not, listen, I am a proponent of gun ownership. You hear me? I own guns. I own an AK-47. I do not support the NRA. I also do not support open carry at all. At all. I don't want to, I don't think that people should show up at protests with guns. I don't. You show up at a gunfight with guns. You don't show up at a demonstration that's a symbolic gathering. And the thing is, I do believe, and in my analysis, that bloodshed is inevitable at some point. Whether the left took up guns or not, that some elements that we are already headed towards a civil war. And I don't mean that from a conspiracy theory or some obscure thing. I think it's already happened that many of those right wingers believe that they already are in a civil war. And then I don't mean like the classic civil war of the United States. I'm talking about a civil war where they're whatever they identify as patriots, white, male, whatever those things, that they believe that they are under attack, and that the only way they can do that is to fight their way out of it against everybody else. And so I think that bloodshed will continue. I don't think the Dylann Roofs are lone wolves. I think they're going to become more and more normalized, the cross between the mass shootings and this. It just doesn't look like classic civil war that we think about, or from the U.S. or what we think of in Spain, where people are building barricades, you know. But I do believe that's going to escalate, and that does not make me happy. It doesn't. I don't find joy in that when I think about that. I don't find any excitement in that.
That's a terrifying prospect, and I think you're.
I think it doesn't sound
feverish to me. I mean, it doesn't sound over the top.
Well,
and I think that we do, you know, sometimes those of us kind of like on the liberal left tend to overestimate the degree to which, you know, like mature democratic institutions can hold up when you have this kind of growing grassroots insurgency and the increasing mainstreaming of these views that, you know, you need your gun to be a bulwark against oppressive government, and how easy that is to then apply that same logic to oppressive, you know, cultural liberalism or whatever your chosen enemy is. We are living in very dangerous times.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a if I could plug, it's not, there's a very good documentary coming out on this this year. It's called American Totem, and it's on gun culture and the complexities of gun culture. And it's not pro or anti-gun. It actually talks about the cultures of gun and some of this the ideas that I've been talking about in here. And it's not a it's a PBS documentary. It's not like some radical, you know, like super radical, you know, coming out of nowhere thing. But I think it's talking about the ideas that we're talking about also across this and the questions that we're asking now. I think it's really important.
Scott Crow, I believe we are out of time. I used up more of your time than I asked for, and I really want to thank you for your generosity.
I appreciate the questions. It was really engaging, and I hope to see you again sometime soon.
Yeah, I would love to have you back on. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be back with David Nywert, who is a big expert on white supremacists. Stay tuned.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace and tell me.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by my old friend David Nywert. He is the Pacific Northwest correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report, and he's also the author of an upcoming book. It's called Alt America: The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. It's coming out in October, and I can't think of a more timely guest. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Joshua. It's always
welcome. Good to talk to you. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah. It's always good to be here.
So, as someone who studied the radical right for many, many years, can you give me a little, like a taxonomy of all the different groups that showed up in Charlottesville last year and last weekend? And I just want to point out that the previous guest, I am of the impression that the militiamen who insisted that they were not there because they were ideologically aligned with the white supremacist groups are in fact ideologically aligned. My past guest is a Texas leftist, and he said, no, we can't lump them all together. Your thoughts?
Well, you can't lump them all together, except the Patriots have been a real steady and constant presence in all of these events. And yeah, there's no question that they're running interference for the thugs who are there showing up at these alt-right events from the far right. And they're also, I mean, in Portland, we saw them tackling Antifa protesters. So, you know, the claim that they're only they're neutrally is bosh. And, you know, and they make it very clear, I mean, from their behavior, that especially the 3%ers and people like that I've seen at some of these rallies, because I've covered, what, 7 of these things now? And yeah, no, their claims of neutrality are, let's just put it politely, as disingenuous as you can get.
Yeah, I think that as well. I want to read you something from the Daily Stormer's Andrew Anglin, and get your reaction to it. He writes, and I quote, "Who are we? Many of us have student loans on degrees that are worthless. Many of us fought in wars for Jews. Many of us have struggled with substance abuse. Many of us are out of shape. We feel emasculated. Many of us feel we never had power. We crave power. We lust after power. We want to be part of a group which will give us power, a group that will confirm our worth as men. We do not have identities. We want identities. We want to be productive. All men want to be productive. We want to build. We want to create. We want to be needed. We have problems with women. All of us do. We lie to each other and claim that we do not, but we all do. We are a generation of throwaways and have been slated to be the last generation of heterosexual white men. We are angry. There is an atavistic rage in us, deep in us, that is ready to boil over." I found this to be, you know, I mean, he has all the kind of Nazi signifiers in there, but there is a certain amount of self-awareness there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he is saying we are a bunch of marginalized losers. Yep. I wanted to get your thoughts about this.
Well, look, that's always been sort of part of their mentality, and yeah, I mean, you can't blame them for you know, as human beings wanting to be accepted, but. You know, it kind of begins with accepting the other human beings on the planet, you know. I mean, this is just ethics 101, right? So, and the fact that they can't even see their way through a simple ethical conundrum like that and instead choose to embrace a hateful ideology that, you know, blames Jews, as this person obviously does, or any other targeted minority group, is just toxic. You know, that stuff's it's bad for your life. I don't know why people do it, but they sure do, because and I gotta tell you, you know, having been around a lot of these folks, they're all poisoned. That's part of the problem, and it's sometimes it's kind of sad. Some of these people are actually sometimes kind of interesting, and there is part of me that feels some compassion for them up until the point, you know, that they start spouting the kind of stuff that right wingers inevitably, these far right wingers always do, which is, you know, hateful stuff and paranoid stuff and suspicious stuff. And, you know, it's really hate. They really hate other parts of society that aren't like them.
How does, though? Well, actually, let me ask you this. Do you think the men's rights movement is a gateway drug for white supremacy and this kind of thing? Because when I was reading this, it just seemed so reminiscent of a certain kind of rhetoric you see in, you know, these corners of Reddit for these people who identify as non-voluntary abstinence, that group, yeah, that says, yeah, you know, yeah. we And they blame others like alpha males for dominating the woman market and stuff like that. And it sounds similar to me in a way.
Well, and I have to say, it's really nothing new, you know, this hatred of women and this sort of misogynistic worldview that is very common. It's actually common, unfortunately, in the video gaming community, or computer gaming community. And but this is nothing new on the far right. In fact, there's a terrific study of the Nazi hatred of women and desire to control women called Male Fantasies by a social scientist named Klaus Teweleit, who went back and found some of the writings of the lieutenants and leaders of these SS squads, and went through and kind of explored, you know, the really violent sexual controlling aspects of them. And so, yeah, this sort of stuff it's really nothing new. It's certainly always been part of the component of far right ideology, this deeply twisted sexual frustration.
Should we be alarmed by the numbers that turned out in Charlottesville, or is that kind of something that we knew that they had such numbers, and how prevalent is this movement? I mean, do we have a tally of the number of people who identify as like these white supremacists, and how is the alt-right and the mainstreaming of the alt-right changing that?
Well, I'll just say this. The numbers of people on the far left, the Antifa and anarchist organizers in the United States are, I would say, in the United States, probably number in the thousands. The people on the alt-right number, I'm sure, it's hundreds of thousands. It's really hard to get a good feel for how large they are, except that we just see these really large social media numbers, and we see fairly large numbers of people turning out for these alt-right rallies. So yeah, I would say that their numbers are in the hundreds of thousands. And yeah, there's a significant movement. And a lot of them, I mean, the most disturbing part is a lot of them are young. I got to say, as somebody who's been following the far right for a really long time, a lot of it is that, you know, the old far right was really a bunch of old fogies, and they had really kind of anachronistic ways, and this is part of why they had no appeal to younger audiences for many generations. This movement is the opposite. They're really wired for young people. They're geared for hitting people on social media. They're geared for impressionable young minds, as well as the minds of people who are, yeah, socially frustrated. And, you know, their lives suck, but it's not because of Jews that their lives suck, you know?
Right. But they're receptive to that message because
Yeah.
their lives suck, and it's better to blame the Jews than to blame your own deficiencies.
Yeah,
And I mean, tell me about efforts in this country. I just wrote a piece this week for Reuters, and I was looking at how in the UK they have these de-radicalization programs, and they really do treat the far right in the same way that they treat Islamic extremists or people who are at risk for radicalization. So they have these programs and they monitor people and blah blah blah. Are we doing any of that in this country? Are there efforts to de-radicalize? Obviously, you're not going to get David Duke, but I believe that there are like 20 some odd goobers that are attracted to this because it's funny to offend people or because they have the problems that we were talking about, these socially maladapted people. Are there efforts to bring them back from the fray?
Well, there certainly are. I mean, so part of that's what the whole countering violent extremism program is supposed to be about. That was begun under the Obama administration, and it was very controversial with the Obama during the Obama years, because initially the Muslim community was very concerned that CVE was just focused on Muslims and that they weren't dealing with the problem of white right-wing extremist radicals and how those people are radicalized also. And it's pretty interesting. A guy named J.M. Berger, who is a terrific terrorism analyst with the George Washington University terrorism counterterrorism program, wrote this terrific analysis of, and he mostly focuses on Islamist radicalization, but he was looking at online radicalization issues, and he said, you know, I have to say that in terms of prospects going forward, especially in terms of positioning on social media, as well as just the sheer raw numbers of participants, that white nationalism is going to pose a much greater threat, security threat to us going forward than Islamist radicalism is going to be. That white nationalist online radicalization, which we now call, which we call the alt-right, is, because that's really what the alt-right is. It's mainly up until these last few months has been primarily an online phenomenon. It's now moving, trying to move into the real world. But as an online phenomenon, you know, it was just, it was functionally an online radicalization mechanism for young men. And it radicalized many large numbers of them.
And the Countering Violent Extremism program was looking at the radical right until the Trump administration came, and they have since refocused exclusively on the Islamic threat, even though you're more likely. Go ahead.
Well, we supposedly those are reports. We don't have that confirmed yet. However, we're still waiting to see who Trump names to replace the person that stepped down from that program. And it's highly likely that he's going to be naming Sebastian Gorka's wife.
Catherine.
Yes, and she's well known as someone who thinks that, who has said that the CVE program essentially is coddling terrorists. So, that tells you, I mean, the fact that they're very clearly already ignoring white right-wing extremists is just going to be exacerbated that much more.
I want to go back to something you said a moment ago. These groups, the Richard Spencer types, I think is fair to say, there's a number of them. They are different. They're not your father's, like, torch wielding. Well, they happen to wield torches, but they're not. They're not your father's hooded rednecks.
Right.
And that's intentional. There was an effort, right, starting in the 2000s, I think, to make the movement more mainstream and to make it more appealing to young people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, that was what white nationalism, even when it started up in the 90s with, you know, Jared Taylor and American Renaissance and those characters, and Peter Brimlow and Vidar. You know, they were always about this sort of suit and tie approach to white supremacy. And that was why, you know, it's essentially that's what white nationalism is. It's just white supremacy rebranded with a different focus. I'll acknowledge there are differences. White supremacists tend to be focused on castigating and belittling the other races and demonizing them and posing themselves as superior, while white nationalists are about excluding other races.
Right.
And ultimately, it's the same thing, but there are sort of behavioral differences. And but it comes down to the same thing. And when you're pushing the agenda, you want to do the same thing. You want to drive all the minorities out of the country. So, or at least force them into some corner where you don't have to see them or something. And, you know, it's just, it's classic nationalist stuff. It's what always happens with nationalism.
Do you think that has been successful insofar as it has it has made them seem more acceptable to some, in some corners at least. And do you think that's played, that shift to button down, we don't hate people, has that played a role in the expansion in these groups' membership since Obama, or was that just a backlash?
All of the above.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of factors.
That's a fair answer.
A lot of things came bubbling up then. And yeah, some of it is backlash. You know, and ultimately, I'm not sure I can suss out the difference between the two. There was a dynamic there in the backlash that was definitely attached to the, you know, sort of political identity, you know, the racial identity issues. So, you know, but this has been, in a lot of ways, this is an outgrowth of the Tea Party, which was explicitly a response to Obama's election. I mean, that was what it was organized around. And that was what it always took its fuel from. But, you know, after 2010, it really became this gigantic conduit for right-wing extremism, particularly first, you know, from the Patriot movement. And then gradually white nationalists started seeping in as well. And that's when it really became the alt-right, as well as the misogynist factor, you know, the whole Gamergate thing, made it partly because this was all happening online, right? So
yeah,
it was really happening in a different dimension. But it all started coalescing online and bubbled up from there.
Let me ask you this. So we've had this moment, a teaching moment perhaps in Charlottesville. What we've seen since then is that a lot of universities have said, we're not going to allow these people on campus. And what they say very consistently is, it's not because of their ideas, it's because they're a public safety threat. Do you think Charlottesville will prove to be a turning point?
Well, one can only hope. Look, as you know, Joshua, I've been beating my head against a brick wall on this
for 30 years.
Yeah, and trying to convince people that these guys are a problem. And so, you know, I'm sorry it took a loss of life and something as horrible as Charlottesville to wake people up. I don't know if it did permanently. I'd sure like to think so. But, you know, we have to see what happens going forward. But, yeah, I would like to think that it's a turning point.
How significant do you think that Trump's dismissal of Steve Bannon will be? On Friday, Trump kicked out Steve Bannon, head of Breitbart. Do you think that's going to lead to a schism between the White House and the white nationalist movement?
You know, I'm hesitant to say. He certainly, Trump really kind of nailed down his bond with the white nationalists on Tuesday. His defense of their march was irrevocable and unmistakable, and his defense of their cause and their, you know, his embrace, you know, he just reiterated the same propaganda points these white nationalists who organized the thing had been saying for months, which what about George Washington, what about Thomas Jefferson? You know, well, they're not, they weren't Confederate generals, Mr. President. So,
yeah. Well, we'll have to see what happens when Breitbart, which has been a very, like, reliable propaganda arm for the White House, turns its fire around and
Will be interesting. I want to see how it plays out. Those folks have already been somewhat dismissed by the alt-right as the alt-light. The sort of the Breitbart sector may peel away, but I wouldn't be surprised if the hardcore alt-righters remain loyal to him. And certainly, you know, I mean, we saw that poll that showed that like 6 out of 10 Trump voters say that there's nothing he could do that would ever turn him against him. So
that's true. And 67% of Republicans approved of his response to Charlottesville, according to CBS poll. Dave, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank Scott Crow. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud. I'd like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars and Hullabaloo and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. And of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a great week, and you know, let's fight some Nazis in whatever way we think is best.